Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.
So, go for it.
Yes.
I don't exactly know how to phrase it, but I'm becoming a lot more aware of negative patterns, and I know that I'm supposed to change my mind and the rest will follow. But it's often difficult to change your mind when you get into patterns. I find myself stuck, like I'm aware of how ingrained the pattern is that I'm following.
Do you then feel like you should do something about the pattern when you're aware of it?
Yeah, and
just
I know
slow
it
down here.
To change my mind.
Do you feel that you should do something about the pattern when you become aware of it?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think that awareness itself is a change of your mind? Because you've been doing this pattern for a long time without being aware, haven't you?
Right.
Do you think that it's possible that the awareness itself could be a change of your mind?
Yeah, it's a start, I think. Yeah.
I would think that you might want to give a little more sense of interest in what happens when you're aware of it before you try to change it.
Okay.
I would think that you might find it's more successful when you become aware that this is a pattern. To be interested in, oh, what is it that makes me aware of it? Oh, what is the feeling of being aware of it?
Okay.
Rather than
having to do something.
Rather than having to do something.
Yeah. Gotcha. I got it.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
I think maybe you understand now why I keep repeating this story about when after I met my beloved teacher Ananda Bodhi. About 3 years after I met him, so that would be 1968, I decided that I really wanted to know more about this meditation stuff. So I was reading all the books. And I was reading this one book on insight meditation, and it said, awareness is a power. You know, I went around for the longest time going, yeah, a power for what? What do you do with it? Not just awareness itself is a power. If there is awareness, your mind has already changed. And the mind has changed because you desire to not be caught by unwholesome states. And how do we change our mind? Because we wish to. And every moment that you make a choice, there is a moment. Every moment that some circumstance arises, there's a moment of choice. Most of the time, we don't want to be aware, so we go to our choosing to do things in a habitual way. If you have prayed to not be caught anymore in a particular unwholesome pattern, or sworn at yourself in the mirror, or whatever it is you call praying, I don't really care what style you use, but that has been your heart's wish. When that pattern gap comes up, there will be a moment of awareness. And awareness is a power. Just be present with the awareness and everything will shift. The difference between not knowing how you got into a state or watching yourself being aware of getting into a state is profound. But I think most of us have read so many fairy tales that we keep waiting for the prince to come or the princess and the magic wand to wave and all of us living happily ever after. And don't recognize the power of this is where we are, and how can we be present in it without suffering? Not how does it all change so that we're not suffering? right? Isn't that what we're looking for? The waiting, looking for the button to push to make it go away. Marge Piercy has that in one of her poems. People ask questions, but never too many. They're looking for the button to push to make it go away. Isn't that a beautiful line? And isn't that what we wish? We wish when we catch ourselves in some suffering state that we knew where the button to push to make it go away is. So the last thing, when the awareness, chance for awareness comes up, we tend to think that that isn't the button. We keep trying to figure, awareness is a power for what? Okay, what do I do with this awareness? Nothing. Just be interested. Oh, what is awareness? Already, that's a different choice. Thanks for the question. Nice question. Yeah, well, took me about 6 years to quit trying to figure out what awareness was a power for. So if I could save you a couple of years, I'm really grateful. Like, I have a dull mind, though. Like beating my head against brick walls. So other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? I thought you said you had a bunch of them, yeah.
Well, at least one. There was one from the reading of the Buddhist Teacher 9 about heretic views. What is heretic views?
Heretic views.
Yeah.
I'd have to see it in context. Does anybody have a copy?
There's
no sugar in my tea. You made it the way Bob makes it. God, I thought when I saw you making it tonight, I would get a good cup of tea.
Yeah.
I mean...
The first set of footnotes in the introduction of chapter 1.
First set of footnotes?
Yeah, I think so. The
page 9 is...
No, I didn't say page 9, just I think the first chapter, there's... maybe it's mentioned, but
what I've got on page 9 is many students have the mistaken idea that they are, quote, working out their karma, end quote, when they find life involves them in situations they cannot quite fathom. But that kind of thinking is based on wrong understanding of what is meant by karma. If you really want to see the working of karma, take a dose of salts. Does that sound like somebody we know? That's activity. If you really want to practice the four foundations of mindfulness, begin by slowing down the body. In the course of a day, stop and watch what posture the body is assuming. Before you move to make it, quote, correct, end quote, see what it is doing. Don't correct too much, just be aware of posture. Is this what the part that it's in?
I was just a secretary. I didn't actually have the book when we did that, so I'm not sure when.
It's in the footnotes. Go to the footnotes.
Okay, page 11, 10.
There's a footnote with
do you know?
Heretical. Let me look for it. Heretical views or whatever.
Oh, so yeah, it would be from Theravadin. Probably from the Pali Text Society.
That's the other question somebody else.
No, we're not in any rush. Take your time. Somebody else has another question they'll ask him. It's hard to answer a question out of context, you know? I think the word heretic actually comes from the same word as heresy. I'm not sure. I think it does.
You have actually looked at it in the dictionary, but it didn't answer our question. It says goes against what is accepted by the group.
Yeah, and heresy basically means goes by public ideas, which are rude understanding rather than the true meaning. So it would have a similar kind of going against the real meaning, or
I think the question was, like, we were just reading this, and I think the lady that was here that had the question, she was curious about it, because she was wondering if they were saying that, she was wondering if they were saying that Buddhism is the only way, and if you thought something else, if that would be heretical, like a Christian view of heresy. And we were thinking that seems odd for, we thought that there's probably a different way of looking at it from Buddhist school.
Mind you, there are many, many Buddhist teachers and monks and nuns who do actually believe, anybody who doesn't believe what they believe, they're heretics. You know, it's true that there are many people in all religions whose devotional energy is so strong that what they believe is right, and if somebody calls it a different name or looks at it from a different angle, that they don't have the real understanding. It's part of, you know, there are some types of people for whom devotion is their full path. Does that make sense to you? That if they see something and they believe it to be true, they can move mountains. Do you know what I mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So for other people, when they feel devotion like that, they immediately have to say, but why do I think that? So they're more what is called twice liberated. They like to have the devotion, but they also go back and say, yeah, but is it really true? I mean, what would happen? And there are other people that only go by what they scientifically feel, you know?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so forth. There are these different categories of ways that people believe, which of course Buddhism has listed. Of course, being so good at laundry lists. And so, and this is true in every religion. So when you meet somebody who is basically a faith type, it's called, when it's translated usually, faith type, and you know they're a faith type, you understand what kind of suffering they're going to go through, because sometimes they will fixate on something as being true, which is not true, and when it's not true, they feel devastated. They don't know that it's the devotion they should be looking at, the power of the devotion rather than the power of the image that one is using to evoke devotion. They're not looking at what is truly transcendental. They're putting their faith in another object to save them, not seeing that that very process itself is the transcendental move. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So you find this in every religion, or every political system, every high school. I truly remember when I used to like those magazines with movie star pictures in them. Of course, you probably never did that. But me, I loved being devotional. And I used to practice kissing under the stairs on the 2x4 that held up part of the stairs. Trying to figure out how to do it right, you know, because an image, my favorite, you know. You know, we do go quite far in our devotional practices. Couldn't imagine being excited about kissing a 2x4 today, however. I could hardly wait to get downstairs. So I think we all have a taste of all of the different ways in our being. You know that when you get past that devotional, when you fall out of love with what was so devotional to you, then the intellect starts picking up, right? And you can see all the reasons why it wasn't a good idea to be in love with them, can't you? So if you really look at yourself, you'll see that in every school. Did you find it, my dear?
Yeah, Sila, then number 10, the 10.
10 marks of Sila?
Yeah, and number 10.
Abstinence from heretic views. Heretic views are views that close the mind. In this case, it means views that close your mind. That's all it means.
like fundamentalism then?
If any view that closes your mind from interest. The whole of the Buddhist teaching is to see things as they are. Isn't that it? Iti piso bhagava, is that right? Seeing things as they are. When you go through the three praises of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, one of the things that is to be seen for your oneself. So, like, there are people whose views cause their mind to be closed. And you can have a view about His Holiness the Dalai Lama, that he is the one and only, and I'm not worthy of trying to meditate with him, but I am his servant, and I'm going to make sure everybody lines up properly and bows right when they're in his presence, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically a closed view to the teaching, because you don't actually believe that people could awaken by hearing that teaching. Does that make sense?
No.
On the other hand, you could see why you don't want to awaken and have devotion to the Dalai Lama, but see why you personally aren't interested in going there this lifetime, because you want to try yet for a couple more lifetimes to be an opera star and a few other things, and you've got a few career choices planned out, and you figured out how you want to go through Bardo and where you want to be reborn, and you're thinking maybe the tropics next time, because Edmonton's okay, but, you know, maybe a summer home there. You know, and maybe you're working it all that way so that you know that all beings can awaken, but you think you'll take the slow path. That wouldn't necessarily be a heretical mind. It's you choosing to ignore what's possible. It's slightly different. But a mind that thinks all beings can't awaken, only those who are great teachers, that would be heretical from a point of view of the Buddhist tradition.
So basically it would be anything that closes the possibility.
Closes the mind from seeing things as they are. Anything that closes the mind from seeing things as they are, and that you cling to that. If basically this tenth mark of Sila has to do with Micha Ditya Viramani, meaning clinging to wrong views. That's what it means. So the translation in the old translation that I used when I wrote the footnote to this was clinging to heresy. But the meaning of heresy is very much clinging to something that is not the true teaching. Is that good? Nice question. I like these questions from body, speech, and mind.
So would it be that any clinging would be heretical?
I mean, if you wanted to be a nitpicking kind of person, you could say that. But if you really understand that the position of Buddhism is not with one fell swoop to kill all clinging, because that would basically end up with insanity. There's no skill in that, right?
Yeah.
That compassion is as important as wisdom. That is the teaching. That not just having the right answer, but being compassionate in that answering. Having the space to feel it, not feeling like you're under attack, right? So, you know, I wouldn't go there myself. I think that's way too narrow-minded. And it's an interesting balance, isn't it? And what is true is that for each person, a heretic mind would be slightly different. Isn't that true? For someone who was subject to a lot of fear, maybe they were raised in a country there was bombing and starvation all the time, and they have this sense of discomfort and ill at ease when they always have to store food. maybe for them that's not hermetic at all. That is the compassion that allows them to relax. Is that true? So why would they stop clinging? That would put them in a state of total fear, wouldn't it? There is, you know, the whole of the path is balanced between those two, you know, clarity and emptiness, or wisdom and compassion, or whatever you want to call them, compassion and wisdom. Clarity is male, intellect. Compassion is male, intellect. Wisdom is female. Being, state of being. What you're trying to do is intelligently enter the state of being. Intelligently be open in a state of being. So it's a balancing act. You basically have to be a funambulist.
What is that?
Funambulist? You mean you don't know?
It's from the Latin, isn't it?
Ambule. What is ambulate?
Walk around.
Walk. Funambulist. It actually means a tightrope walker. That's the word for tightrope walker. Isn't it a great word? I love that word. Funambulist. You just drop it into a conversation. Watch how many people are actually as brave as Otto. And how many go, it's a beautiful word, eh? Funambulist.
I live near the university, too, so...
You could try it.
Yeah.
On a really windy day, you go out and look at the telephone lines and say, oh, not a good day for funambulism. It's a delicious word. And we're all funambulists, aren't we? We're all trying to balance on this very, very risky position of present moment. We keep getting pulled in every direction, but the only place there's any life or power is in the here and now. Because when you think about the future, you don't have power in the present. When you think about the past, you don't have power in the present, right? And it's a continuous balancing act between knowing and being. To bring the knowing state into the being state. That's what it's about, isn't it? When you look at your life, when have you been most happy? When you have been consciously present. Is that true? So the 10 marks of Sila are basically, Sila is morality. And you have that paper I wrote on it, don't you? You have that somewhere. The 10 marks of Sila are basically all showing you the ways that you are not present in each one of them. You know? The four have to do with speech, right? Don't they? Two with body. Four, or is it three with body? Yeah, three with body, four with speech, three with mind. Isn't that true? How many of you don't remember? How many of you aren't going to answer no matter what I ask?
It's downstairs on the table.
Yeah, it is downstairs on the table. Panadipata, first one. to refrain from taking, killing, and harming. To refrain from killing and harming, first one. Second one, adina dana, to attain, restrain from taking that which is not freely given. That's an interesting thing, isn't it?
Can I ask a question?
I hope so.
When you look at this and you say, okay, to practice that, but isn't that sort of like going actually against nature, the way nature is made up?
What do you mean by nature, my dear?
Well, the dynamics of things happening the way they do.
When things continue to happen the way they do, what am I doing in that kind of environment? Am I actually making choices, or am I just reacting?
Maybe both.
Do you think you're making choices if when something happens, you...
Yeah, I see what you mean, yeah.
So if a human life is based only on reaction, then of course you don't bother with these. But if you think a human life is capable of something more than just reacting to circumstances, then you might want to practice these. And these are not, you must do this. These are like, I undertake to train myself as much as I am able to not take what isn't freely given. That means you want to be aware of what choices you have in that flow, which is a very different thing, isn't it? And again, we're back to the power of awareness. If I decide I want to be aware of whether or not I'm about to take something which I know isn't freely given, and I say, okay, well, but I know this isn't freely given. Do I still want to take it? Well, I wonder what would happen if I didn't. Right? Now I'm human. Because I want to see things as they are, not just according to my gut reaction. I don't want to just be reactionary. I want to understand something at a deeper level. Does that make sense?
Yeah, aren't you sort of, in a way, dislodging yourself from...
You bet you're sweet bippy. From just unconscious reacting. You bet you're sweet bippy. And it's very hard to do, and very few people will do it. As much as you are able to do it, to that extent, you have a better idea of how to move compassionately for the sake of all beings. If you're always just reacting, you have no power. Isn't that true? If you start having choices about how you want, whether you want to react or whether you want to choose not to react, you start to have more understanding of what you can accomplish in your life or what you can't. Is that true? Or what a life might be, or what somebody else could be. You know, very often, if you have a child living, a new baby in your house, the kid will cry in the middle of the night. Your gut reaction is to, I'm tired, I don't want to get up. But there's something in you that says, oh, my child. Is that true? And you get up even though you're tired. And you know what that does? It actually makes you love your child more. Doesn't it? Have you seen people do that? They actually, because you wake up in the middle of the night sleep deprived, and they have this kind of little glow around them because you're in this hypnotic state. And you start falling in love with their little fingernails and toenails and their noses and everything again. And then you go back to sleep and you're still sitting there by the crib watching them. And you stagger back to bed. So you have this moment of beauty that you wouldn't have if you just followed the, oh well, they'll cry themselves out and go back to sleep and I can get more sleep because I'm tired. Is that a good example or not? I'm not sure it's a good example, because one could say that the reaction to a newborn baby's cry is to go and see whether they're okay. So that's why I'm asking you, does that cover the bases or not?
Somewhat.
Okay. Do you have some idea what you would like to ask that I haven't addressed here?
Well, I'm just not quite so clear on that, to where that is, that you say, okay, you do as much as you can.
As much as you are able.
Or able, yeah. Because if you push yourself, you can be able a lot more.
But you're not willingly able to do that. You're pushing yourself beyond what you're actually able to do. It's not saying you do as much as you can discipline yourself to do. If you actually pay attention to practicing doing as much as one is able, it's a really beautiful exercise. Because sometimes you're not able. If you give, you're going to end up resenting that you didn't keep it for yourself. So you gave more than you were able to freely give. Is that true? So the actual expression, do as much as one is able, which is one of the phrases in the loving kindness teaching given by Shakyamuni Buddha, I have found to be a very powerful motive maker, very powerful mantra to work with. I have many times in my life, in various places around this planet, taken that line and tried to make it my daily practice. And it's sometimes very interesting how I am not willing to do as much as I am able, and how many times I am willing to do more than I am able, and to actually become sensitive to that point, because it's a moving point. And just that second one of the 10 marks of Sila, you know, do not take what is not freely. I undertake to train myself to refrain from taking that which is not freely given, is very interesting, because it applies on both sides of your skin, doesn't it? It's amazing how much more honest you become by following that one. And I'm not saying righteous, I'm saying honest. How much more comfortable you get with yourself. You know what you're willing to give, and you know what you're not willing to. That's very nice, to love yourself that much. Mm-hmm. When you love yourself, you start loving others, don't you? Huh? It's my experience. If I don't love myself, I'm not going to be very nice to anybody else. Are you? Are you nice to others when you don't love yourself?
I can pretend.
Yeah, but really?
I'm sorry.
No, you are not. You're just a funambulist.
But that's a really slippery thing, though, because like you said, it moves,
it's a moving point, and it requires awareness. You have to actually be present, which is against our natural reaction. When we're reacting, we can be half asleep. We just let the habits run us. When you're actually present, and being present in every moment to see how much you are able, that makes a whole different ballgame, doesn't it? Maybe you're able to not be aware right now, so you do that. Okay, I'm going to dull out. Okay, I'm aware that I'm dulling out. Oh, damn. The idea is not to discipline yourself to the point of breaking. In the Buddhist tradition, it's to see things for oneself. The only time that real discipline comes in is when you know that you have tested things as much as you are able, and you realize that you want to find out, other than you in relation to other, is there a consciousness? And that takes a long time, because basically what you're doing is, if there is no purpose, who am I? And isn't that one heaven of a question? Because most of our meaning comes from having a purpose. If we don't have a purpose, we feel lost, meaningless, right?
Mm-hmm.
Despair. Right? But to actually be interested in, because when you die, what happens to your meanings? To be actually interested in that state beyond self, how to be conscious there without clinging to self. What is the consciousness without subject-object duality? So in Buddhism, to see things as they are, with non-clinging, compassionate awareness. This is not an easy thing. You're not going to do it overnight or on one, 10-day insight retreat. Maybe Jack, but the rest of us, we're not.
Sorry, I missed
that. Okay?
Yeah.
Anybody else? It's your night, come on. Ask me questions.
But
it's just that we went through the first two marks of Sila, could we continue?
Sure. Well, I like the way they're written in the one downstairs. Somebody want to go downstairs and get that off the table? You want to go? You're going to go, Pat? Thanks. It's very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's also killing and harming in there, too.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. And I think, for me, one of the most profound things about really taking on the 10 marks of Sila and trying to understand them was to realize how impossible they are to really maintain. And then that tripped me into understanding Paticca-samuppada, which is basically that we're not separate from each other. I can't separate myself from dinner. Dinner can't separate itself from me either. Breathing. I don't know whether that air was freely given, do you? You know, the thing about the 10 marks of Sila is that you have to give up false views of perfection, because perfection is not possible in the material world. But as you start to study the material world and you start to soften about what you expect of it, that softening allows you to see that actually the material world is not material. And from practicing the 10 marks of Sila comes a very profound insight into what they call emptiness or wisdom. No inherent identity comes from that, which is part of the Orange Tara profound understanding. What's so? No inherent identity. Who is there that's going to die? Who can be there? No inherent identity. One is the self of your bones. Where did they come from? Zen koan, give your bones back to your father, your flesh back to your mother. Who are you then? It's not you. It's not your. It's hanging on to a view is not, does not make a self. Does it? Is that true? So when you actually start practicing with the 10 marks of Sila, it is a very fast path to develop the wisdom of no inherent identity. Or like Buckminster Fuller said, God is a verb. There ain't no nouns, folks. It's all just verbs. It's a flow of action. A lifetime is a river and a riverbed, both changing all the time. And where does a river end? It doesn't. There's like clouds. Where do the clouds end? They don't. There's like rain. Where does the rain end? It doesn't. There's like a puddle and a stream. Is that right? Which is the real river? Yes. Or, on the other hand, no. Or maybe even, maybe. Is that true? So the thing about the 10 marks of Sila is they take your focus off the material world and start you to understand that there isn't an inherent fixity that is right or wrong or good or bad. They bring you into the wisdom of Orange Tara, Prajna Paramita, the Great Mother, the flow, the Heart Sutra, the Heart Sutra. What the heart knows, not the bloody brain. The brain takes pictures, and you know how we love to keep our pictures framed and still. You know, that polar bear will always be exactly there, swimming in the ice. And when it really catches me is when I am moving with it, not when it's frozen there, swimming. Is that true? A picture should remind us of the flow, shouldn't it? You can't capture a moment. A moment can capture you. Am I making sense?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's pretty amazing. So, the 10 marks of Sila, Panatipata, where all many comes from, pan, long, P long A, Spanish N, A without over it, comes from the word prana, which means life or breath. Ati mean to attack. So if you tend to hold your breath, you're not doing panatipata. You're attacking your breath. I wonder if that means if you use mouthwash or something like that. Do you think mouthwash qualifies as attacking your breath? Because you kind of go, when you do it. Maybe, I wonder if we have to ban mouthwash in our new school that is forming, the Sila school. No mouthwash. If you use mouthwash, you'll go to hell. I think we are onto something here. We better check this out. Pata from pat from patata patati, not potato. Patati means to fly, to fall. From this comes the Latin word for quick or peto, to go for, or also our English word impetus comes from the same root, meaning to attack. And it means to fall, jump, fall down on. So panati pata is to cause prana to fall, to cause the life or the breath to fall. The harming, killing the life force. What an interesting thing to undertake to train myself to refrain from doing, both inner and outer. Okay? What an interesting discipline, just that one by itself. The next one, adinadana, varamani. Not din taking, plus dana, and not given. Not taking the not given. Pretty straightforward. A brahmacharya varamani, not going as the Brahmins go. Well, you all understand that one, so we can move right on. Don't you understand that one? Or kame sumichachara varamani, which is often how it's quoted in the precepts, isn't it? Kame sumichachara. Always sounds like a Latin American dance. Michachara. Kame su, the English word whore, 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 is derived from this same word, kame. Through the Indo-European root kar, QAR, to Norse, German, Dutch, English. That's where we get it. In the Southern European countries, this root kar, QAR, became karas or kara, to hold dear, be fond of. Fond in the north of Europe was a simile for foolish, vain, swaggerer. Whereas in the south, it was to dote, to be affectionate. Because in the north, if you became fond, you might freeze to death, right? So to be interested in a car, a fondness, was like a whore. It could rob your life, right? Whereas in the south, he couldn't freeze to death, so it was kind of a nice feeling to be doting. So it's, oh, cara mia, you know. Interesting, huh? Same root, and in two different geographies, how different it was. I like that. You knew that. In a similar way, kama, as sense, desire, and enjoyment, describes all but the most refined conditions of life from a Buddhist standpoint. All but the most refined. Kama can refer to an object of sensual enjoyment as well as to the desire for pleasure. So looking to the Tipitaka, the Mahanidesa particularly describes kama as subjective and objective. So it's both the desire for pleasure and the object that is found to be pleasurable. It's both subjective and objective. And in the Vimanavatu, which is a much later part of the Pali Canon, the commentator lists six categories of kama which obstruct the development of clarity and insight. And so here's the point. Kama, kamesu, refraining from a sensuality that fogs the mind. Do you understand? Because these six categories of kama obstruct the development of clarity and insight. The first one is pleasant objects. Why do pleasant objects obstruct the mind? want more, and also you just surround yourself with all these beautiful things and you just keep looking at the beauty of them, right? So you don't focus on the fact that while I'm looking at the beauty of this, I'm dying. Right? You lose your energy. Don't you? Is that true? It isn't that for some people who have a little too much energy, they shouldn't be surrounded by beautiful things. But there are most people, if they are surrounded by beautiful things, they won't focus on trying to see what is beyond meaning, because it makes the mind soften too much. You got that puzzled look on your face.
When I feel really here, everything seems really beautiful.
Absolutely. That's true. But to only surround yourself with things that are beautiful even when you're not feeling really here. And having to have them.
And letting it become a distraction.
It is a distraction.
The beautiful thing is the distraction for allowing yourself to...
Your need for them is a distraction. And the beautiful thing is a distraction. Both subject and object. I know people who can't meditate unless they have a perfect shrine. You ever met anybody like that? You're certainly not looking at somebody like that, but... I do. I know people who can't meditate unless... Or if there's traffic going by. You ever met anybody like that? Or if the kids are playing outside their window. Right? If it is anything but a perfect circumstance, they can't meditate. Is that possible? So they're too attached to a certain level of beauty to be able to see things as they are. They have to have special conditions. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's all. So the second one is Chandra Raga. And it means impulsive passion. You know, there are people who really want to have high experiences. Every time they meditate, they're looking for a high. Or people who love to fall in love. You know? Or who are always looking for something to affirm their, you know? It's like they know they're alive if something special is happening. That's the second one. The third one is sabasmin lobha, which means greed for anything. Just right across the board. Just greedy, always, everything wants to. The fourth one is gamadama, which means sexual lust. You're sitting there and you're meditating and then suddenly you really want to get it on with somebody. They will do. And you have fantasies, sexual fantasies when you're meditating. It's a stage that usually you come and go through. If you're lucky. Go. And the next one is hitachanda. And it's literally the effort to be useful, the desire to be useful. So these are all the kinds of sensual desire that will obstruct you from carrying on. You understand what I was saying about meaning, how we're so attached to meaning? The desire for beauty, the desire for have a great impulsive passion in your life, meaningfulness, right? Special meaning, to have greed for anything, go and get things, I want to go shopping. Sexual lust, desire to be useful, to do good. I think one or two of you must know that one. And the last one is called Saribhava, and the desire to be independent, self-willed. So these are the five kinds of sensual desire or desire that block one from seeing things as they are. And you see, they all give you a purpose or give you a meaning. They're all subject-object, aren't they? Isn't that interesting? And then I go more deeply into the fourth one, which is Gamadhamma. When I did this write-up, I thought it was important to clarify this. The literal meaning of Gamadhamma indicates a much broader discipline than is suggested by its usual translation as sexual lust. Dhamma means truth, law. Gamma comes from the Vedic grama and means heap, collection, perish. There is evidence to support that this root word was transported for Greek and Latin usage. Latin has grex, a collection of houses, a hamlet. In German there is geminid, a habitable place. Gamma would translate well as meaning small town. A gamma would not have large markets or malls. In the time of the Buddha, a gamma was the ideal place to go on alms rounds, so many references to it as a source of support. So sexual lust would actually be that sense of support, personal support, taken to some extreme, right? In time of the Buddha, a gamma was the ideal place to go on alms rounds, so many references to it as a source of support for the ordained occur in texts. Although not literally so, the meaning of Gamadhamma is taken as being overly involved with the women of the village, and even and even vile conduct. It is easy to understand how one who had taken the vows of homelessness might find that regular interaction with villagers could cause the desires for companionship, love, and procreation to be stimulated. It is easy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
In more traditional terms, passion, impulse, and greed, the most frequently occurring manifestations of kama, will arise when supportive circumstances, coupled with lack of awareness, are present. As lust is perhaps the strongest of these desires, Gamadhamma, or desire for village life, became identified with sexual lust. Is that helpful?
Mm-hmm.
And in the Anguttara Nikaya, or Gradual Sayings, the Buddha discourses on the unlikelihood that one, with mind stirred and muddied by desire, can understand either his own profit or that of others. If your mind is stirred by desire for anything beyond where you can see where you are, then how can you understand either your own profit of that of others, or that of others? Impossible for him to understand both his own profit and that of others, or to realize states surpassing those of ordinary minds, the excellence of truly noble knowledge and insight. So therefore, desire, sensual desire to be not caught in it, is very important for you to understand beyond your grasping for meaning. Right. So Musawada is the next one. Musa means neglect, not plus lagare, to choose to not pick something up. Musawada means to choose to not pick up. Going along, choosing to not pick up, is a way to talk about lying. When you're talking to someone or representing yourself and somebody asks you, you know, are you bringing any illegal contraband into the country and you've got 52 tons of marijuana in your suitcase, you say, I certainly don't mean to bring anything illegal. I'm much more honest than that. Because you choose to not pick up the fact that you've got... That's one that's usually... Does that make sense? Okay, that's usually translated as lying. to choose to not say something. That's usually what Usawada is translated as lying, but that's really what it comes from. And Visuna Vachaya Viramani from the root word Pisacha, which means fiend or demon, literally means using speech to demonize, to make someone into a demon or yourself into a demon. Do you understand?
That's a little like finding evidence.
Yeah, very much so. And the next one, Parusa Vachaya Viramani, is speech that's used like a hatchet or an axe to actually cut people. One is to make somebody into bad, and or yourself into bad or just solid, and the next is to cut somebody down to cause actual harm. They're very different, aren't they? And the next one is called Sampa Palapa Viramani. Sampa Palapa Palapa. Palapa is where we get the English word pollard. Do you know that word, pollard? If you've done a lot of gardening, you know that word. Via Latin, palea, which means, in Latin, it means the chaff of the corn. And in translation is frivolous talk. Pollard is the bran shifted from flour. The bran is the germ or the active part of the grain, isn't it? Did you know that? You take the bran out of something, you're taking the active part. So white flour doesn't rot as fast as brown flour. White rice doesn't. So the rich people ate white bread because they could store vast amounts of flour and so that they were rich. And the poor people ate brown bread because they couldn't afford to keep the flour, they had to eat it. You understand? That's where we got our white bread and our brown bread. And now it's sort of turning because people are recognizing the nutritious value of bran. Is that true?
Yeah.
And so that sort of now you pay more for brown bread than you do for bread. Used to be the other way around, you know? Now if you can afford to buy it every day, you're rich, but if you can't, you buy Wonder Bread, which lasts for a year. Right? So the word bran shifted from flour. Animals who have cast their horns. When do deer cast their horns? After they've made it. Is there a pattern going on here? Bran separated from wheat means the life energy of the wheat is taken out. Animals that have cast their horns, they're called pollard. Pruned tree. When you prune a tree, what are you doing? You're cutting off the branches you don't want to grow, right? All of which point to a lack of fecundity. So Sampa Palapa Viramani actually means speech that castrates, speech that deadens, speech that leaves no energy. And it's translated as gossip. But it really means deadening speech. Speech that deadens. Nice, isn't it? And the next one is Abhijaya Viramani, which is taking possession and mastering from Abhi, as in English, coming by, and overcoming means the same thing as overcoming or coming by. I came by this beautiful brooch when I was looking in my jewel, you know, overcoming. Thus, A, facing and aggressing toward, against, onto, at, and B, mastering over, along, over, over. So an idea of increasing, of intensifying the action implied by the verb, used to indicate very much, greatly. Jaya, to shine, perceive, cunning, meditate, contemplate, think upon, brood over, search for, hunt after. So, abhijaya varamani means covetousness in brooding over, going over and over the same thoughts, or over and over wanting the same possessions, or nice, eh? Vyapada varamani comes from V plus A plus Pad. V is duality, separating, against, a way, a place, a position, a thing, a principle, against. And pada means walking. So walking in opposition or walking against, and it means ill will or malevolence. Going against something. Last one, Micha Ditti Varamani, which is the one that they were using for heresy in the book, in the footnote. Micha means separate, opposite, contrary, mitu, wrongly, false, plus Ditti, view, belief, dogma, theory, speculation. And three types of view are emanated, Micha Ditti, Ditti, and Samma Ditti. Ditti means partial view. Relative view. Micha Ditti means opposed to truth. Samma Ditti means total view. Ten, and then I have 10 commonly held views that you can read yourself that contradict full understanding and are considered to be the Micha Ditti. But if you want to read this, this is downstairs, is it? So you can get your own copy. And take it home and forget it one more time. So, wisdom is purified by morality, and morality is purified by wisdom. Where one is, the other is. Isn't that lovely? The moral man has wisdom and the wise man has morality. And the combination of morality and wisdom is called the highest thing in this world. Just as one hand washes the other, or one foot the other, if you're in India, so wisdom is purified by morality, and this combination is called the highest thing in the world. That was very long-winded. Was that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could just take it home and read it yourself anytime you want.
That's better to have it.
Is it?
Literally in company.
Yeah, it is.
It's the same suffering.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's true. It's nice to have stories read to us. So, did you remember, or do you have a question, or did you want to forget it?
Well, it has to do with finding a sense of worthiness.
A lot of the time, people who have difficulty feeling worthy, it's because it's a habit. You know, we have this kind of sense of like it as opposed to, but we don't look at what we're comparing ourselves to. There is something that makes us not worthy, but we don't ever look at what it is that we habitually are trying to be worthy in relation to. Is that true? And there's just this feeling that, you know, could it come because, you know, one time somebody asked you to open a door and you closed it by mistake because you were in a house you weren't used to, and then they freaked out and screamed and yelled, and a bird flew into the window and died, and you couldn't stop the bird from dying. You associated all the things together, so you were just unworthy. You can't even close the door, you know. Mm-hmm. So then that pattern just kind of stays there. So, like, the real question is not whether or not you're unworthy, or whether there is unworthiness, or whether another person has awareness. Unworthiness, the question is it possible for me to allow myself to see worthiness? Which is much more interesting too, isn't it? And so then you can start playing around with little things like the six givings a day. You know that one. Where six times a day you give something. Mm-hmm. And only two of them can be material. Mm-hmm. You know, only two of them can be actual material because that's too easy. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll give my house to Jack and I'm leaving. You know, you can't do that. Well, you can do it, but only once a day.
Yeah.
but what you have to do is say, okay, I'm going to give looking at those flowers to my eyes. I'm going to give 1 second of looking at those flowers to my eyes. Mm. You say it, and you watch the giving, and then you drop it. Mm. And then you go, okay, I'm going to smile at Otto for a minute. Because it's so nice to do. Okay, I did that. Remember doing that? I gave a smile. I don't know who I gave it to, Otto, or I gave it to myself. I'm not sure, but it doesn't matter. I gave it. And then six givings in a day. And then at night, and the only criteria is that you have to be conscious of the giving. You have to name the giving and then watch yourself give it. Mm-hmm. So you're not involved with what happens to the recipient or anything. Mm-hmm. You're just looking at the giving. Then before you go to sleep at night, you have to review the six things you gave that day. Let's see, I looked at the flower for a minute, I gave a smile to Otto, I gave the house to Jack. And if you haven't done six, you get up and you do them. You can do the last one, can be okay. I give myself the right to go to bed. But you actually review them every night. And then you say, I wonder what I'll give tomorrow. You're not going, oh, I should have done this before you go to sleep. Mm-hmm. You're going, oh, I gave six things today. I wonder what I'm going to give tomorrow. And every time your mind starts wandering, you think, oh, yeah, I gave six things today. That was neat. I wonder what I'll give tomorrow. And you just keep bringing your mind back to that. So that essentially you go to sleep with that as your thought. I wonder what I'll do. And then you wake up and your mind's starting to go through its old pattern. You say, oh wow, I gave six things yesterday. I wonder what I'll do today. I give myself the right to go back to him hitting the snooze button. Actually, it's kind of fun giving yourself the snooze button. I wonder how long I could do it for. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, but like you have to consciously decide each one. You can't do them habitually now. You have to be conscious of the giving now. You can still do exactly the same givings, but you're conscious in them and you're watching the giving. And I guarantee if you do that for a period of 3 weeks, you will notice a difference in that feeling, or the person, whoever it is, anyone, will notice a difference in that feeling of being unworthy. Because it isn't that, you know, we all, any human being is more wholesome than unwholesome, and we perform more wholesome acts in a day than unwholesome acts every day. But if your habit is to think of yourself as being unworthy in relation to big black mystery, then you have to consciously bring in seeing the worthiness to actually get that unconscious pattern to move over a little bit and put a new tape on the tape deck. It's your mind. But trying to figure out why you're unworthy, that's kind of the slow way. Or who did what to who. I mean, you can do that, but I think it has limited value. Better just quit being unworthy and start being worthy. And make a point of telling yourself that. And just see what happens. You know? Whether it's you or whoever, I don't know who you're asking for, but it's just like, I would recommend one look at it that way. And in that process, you can watch you will be able to watch the little fears that come up about, you know, whatever it is, the being can watch what fears don't let, making them don't want to be worthy, what danger there is about being worthy. Because there's probably some dangers, you know. You were telling me about Don bought a new TV, and it, you know, it took you what? About a week to really enjoy watching it. The first time I bought a computer, I brought it home in the box, and I shoved the box under my desk, and I left it there for 3 days. Took me 2 weeks to actually use it in Vancouver. Took me 3 weeks to actually plug it in and use it. I was like, you know, I'm not worthy. I shouldn't give myself. It's interesting, isn't it? And until you actually start being interested in those patterns and saying, but, you know, on the other hand, I don't know where that came from. I wonder if I could explore it a bit. I mean, it's your life. If you want. The option is always there to move in. You don't have to be an absent landlady, you know? You could actually move in. It's okay. You got 10 minutes. Yes.
Just a quick question. When you're talking about being aware, like you do.
I have been talking about that, yes, off and on for a few years.
But
mostly to remind myself.
The trick is not to actually have to have an answer to, isn't it? Like, it just occurred to me, I just got this sense that it's the asking of the question that's important, not going, well, okay, so where's the answer?
Yeah, it took me about 6 or 7 years to realize that awareness was a power, period. Not for what. An answer is for what, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't
you
it?
Said that earlier.
Yeah, I know, sweetheart.
Yeah.
And you get it?
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter when you get it.
Yeah.
It isn't an issue that I said it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an issue. It's absolutely not an issue. What is profound is how true it is that we always want something to be about to happen. We always want to do good and then get our reward. There is this enormous addiction to becoming. And to let go of it and just be here is why we need each other. Because we keep reminding each other how important it is. If I am going to be a lover, I have to be here. Don't you?
I didn't hear the last part.
If I am going to be a lover, I have to be here.
Oh.
Don't you? And if I'm always waiting for it to happen, whether good or bad, I'm not a lover. I'm not here. You know, I'm trying to get the right answer or the right wrong answer or freezing or all that. That's all not loving. Who is here? Isn't it? So that's what we want. And that's how we support each other. You know, one of the refuges is community.
Mm-hmm.
And it is bloody important, however much some of us love to poo-poo it. Because we're not sure how we respond to others, whether they like us or we like them. The truth is, without each other, we don't have a home. We all know that, don't we? We all do know that. It isn't whether you or I are perfect. It's whether we keep stumbling in and out of awareness so we make each other wake up. Perfect is not an option. Not in this realm. Awareness, however, is the option. So how's that? Is that good?
Yeah.
When you're talking about no one here itself, I know, I've heard. Did you just say there's no, it's like there's no static in here itself? That there is a self, it's just...
There's a continuously coming into being and passing away of itself.
So there is a self.
There's pictures. Like a movie is what? A bunch of stills running really fast with a story meaning woven through it to keep the next scene coming, right?
Yeah.
That's what a self is.
So there is a self? It's just changing all the time?
There is a non-inherent self. There is a coming into there every moment. There is a new self born every moment that new self dies.
Like a flame.
There's
like
coming into being and passing away. Like a movie.
It's not that I'm not here.
It's not that there is no, not presence. There is something. That something is a cause and effect dance. It's not a fixed permanent identity. That's what emptiness means. Not fixed permanent identity. Isn't that beautiful?
I thought there was like supposed to be this.
No.
Nothing. Like.
Well, it is. It's no thing. There is thinging, but there's no thing. There's no fixed. There is play. Coming into being and passing away. I know, we all think that. When you hear the word shunya or emptiness. Mm. Oh God, you mean, but what is that? Mm. How do I pull the plug? If there's emptiness, who's going to pull the plug? Nice, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's already so close that it's really hard to grasp.
It is. That's right on. So you can. But then you don't have to because it's a new one now anyway. So the Buddha said not in the past, not in the future, neither between the two. Not between the two. When there is an opening to just being in the present, you're stepping outside of linear time. But that's for another class. I thought it might be interesting, maybe when I'm have come out of the retreat and you've checked to see whether I was done or not next year. If you've all poked and prodded me and seen whether I've achieved a reasonable amount of doneness, and you decide to put up with me anyway, even if I haven't, that we might maybe do some classes on tarot. I think we have just kind of neglected the Western mystery traditions, the Western mystical paths, and the tarot has a lot of that mysticism in it. Does that sound interesting to you? Mm-hmm. I was looking at my own, the teaching that I have received, especially from my beloved teacher, Namgyal Rinpoche, and how much time he spent with me on tarot, and I thought, you know, I should do that. I can remember 3 different times that he went through the tarot teaching with me in quite different ways all 3 times. So it would be nice if I honored that somehow. Mm-hmm. So if you think that would be good, we could try that. I think that would be interesting. And some of you were there for a lot of it, so you can give me a hand with it. So, la-di-da, could you tomorrow? Thank you for your kindness. Thank you for your support. is this beautiful gold lane in your heart. Spreads through your body.
Where there's nobody there.
Or somebody.
Or isn't nobody.
Or is it somebody? Make a good jig, wouldn't it? Moves through your whole body, this gold light, it just pours out your pores like a giggle. Fills this room. The house. The block. All of Edmonton. Into the earth. Into the sky, into the earth. All of North America. Anyone you want to pray for, just imagine them washed with the gold light. The whole earth. Out into space. Wherever there's suffering due to ignorance of body's feature of mind is just temporarily assuaged, and you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beasts of the earth. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings of the earth. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings of the earth.
So thank you for your great compassion.
Thank you.